This week on Writers, Inc.
People say, how do I know if my story or my script is any good? And that is, the answer is really, you give it to somebody and anybody, your mother, your father, whoever you trust, and you say, read it. And they're going to say, what do I know? I'm not a literary agent. And you're going to say, yeah, but you're my reader. And the answer is, give it to them to read, give them a week. When they come back, what do you think? And they're going to say, well, I like this part or I like that part. Like, that's not good enough. They have to be really, they have to love the whole thing. And what you're going to ask them is, when you get to the bottom of the page, did you want to turn the page? Did you want to find out what happens next? Or did it feel like a homework assignment? And if it felt like a homework, did it feel like a homework assignment or a gift? And if it felt like a gift, you've done your job. And that applies to thriller, romance, comedy. It's all writing. It's the same, you know, mandate.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out. School's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So I got my daughter a bike yesterday. For the first time, I've been bugging her to try and get a bike forever. Like, all her friends have bikes. Like, we live across the street from the elementary school. And like, it's so cool to see little kids riding their bike to school. And I'm like, don't you want to do that? She's like, No, I don't think so. She's got a scooter. She's got a skateboard. But like, for whatever reason, she was like deathly afraid of bikes. And I finally talked to her about it. And she's like, well, they tip over. And like, I explained to her what training wheels were. Because like, apparently she didn't know, and like, she never really took a close look at like some of her friends' bikes and realized that they have little wheels on the back holding it up. So yeah, so I got her training wheels, I got her a bike, got her out there, and she, for the last 3 or 4 days, she's ridden it to school. And it's like, honestly, it's like the cutest thing in the world to watch her out there with her mom walking to school riding her little bike. So
that's awesome. My son was afraid to ride his bike too. I remember when I took the training wheels off is when he was afraid. And I had to take him to like a little grassy hill at the park and hold him and let him go to get the balance for it.
Oh.
So he wasn't afraid of falling on the grass, but he was afraid of the pavement.
My son was the exact opposite. He was very angry that he had to have training wheels. He did not want the training wheels. He very anxious to be like, well, that's not how bikes work, so take those off. And it was like, well, can we just get used to the bike first for just a minute?
It was a whole day thing for me because like we went to the store. We went to Walmart, then we went to Target, then we went to this store, and like she finally found a bike that she liked. So then we got the bike, but that store didn't have training wheels. And then we had to go back to Walmart, get training wheels, go back home. So it was like 3:30, 4 o'clock in the afternoon by the time, because then I had to break out the tools and get the training wheels on the bike, you know,
right,
which is a whole other thing. If you're, you know, not that it's hard to do, but it, you know, it's time consuming. And you know, like I had to run inside, get this wrench, then come back outside and realize, oh, I need a different wrench. And yeah, so it was a project, but yeah, it's fun to see. And you had an anniversary, right?
I did yesterday. It was a Wednesday. So I guess not yesterday as we're recording this, but yeah. And so I decided to make ahi tuna for dinner for our anniversary. And my husband was calling it our tuniversary, which if there is not something more romantic than that, I don't know what it is. So I think it'll be our tuniversary every year from
like
now on.
One is paper, right? Like I forget which one. So which one is tuna? What year are you?
Nine is apparently tuna.
Is tuna. Got it.
Nice.
Okay.
Interesting. All right.
I'm sure there's a card for that.
Yeah. There's going to be now. I'm going to make one.
All right. Well, Kevin is out. He is traveling. Jenna, you are going to do the news, right? What is in the news?
I am. All right. Let's see if I can do this. All right. Penguin Random House dismisses two of its top publishers. Penguin Random House dismissed Regan Arthur and Lisa Lucas, top publishers at Alfred, Knopf, and Pantheon, and Shocken Imprints, respectively. Lisa Lucas publicly shared her surprise about her dismissal on social media, noting she was informed on a Monday morning without prior indication. The company cited the need for restructuring to support future growth. Jordan Pavlin, the editor-in-chief at Knopf, will take over as publisher, filling both roles. The editorial department of Pantheon will now report to Doubleday. So that happened.
Yeah, this is the same kind of shakeup that we've been seeing. Like, I think they're just doubling down. And, you know, it's unfortunate. But, like, if you look at this from a business standpoint, these are people that have been there for a long time, which means they're probably expensive. And they're being replaced with somebody that's probably a little bit cheaper and younger to keep the, yeah. you know, the machine going, which, you know, doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, that's the right decision. I mean, in my mind, it's obviously the wrong decision. You don't get rid of somebody that's got experience just to save a buck. But, I mean, that's got to be what they're doing. And it's sad.
It is. I've seen this a lot with, you know, I used to do business consulting a long, long time ago. And this is a very common thing that most consultants advise against, actually, because, you know, people like to look at the numbers of bottom lines and it's like, well, it's this salary and it's this. But there are so many intangibles that go with that experience and that higher paycheck. Sometimes not, but for the most part, you can't necessarily equate, you know, skills and experience and all of those things with, you know, a number. And sometimes, you know, the truth is you just got to take the hit on the P&L to write out whatever trend is currently happening in the market. And, you know, a lot of businesses don't like hearing that, but that is the truth. And, you know, it, they save a dollar in the short term, but then, you know, when trends change, they're often behind because they don't have, you know, the skills and the experience needed to pick right up and keep going. So it's, I don't know the exact details on this, but it's, I'm always skeptical when I read things like this of like, was that really the good move or are you just trying to save a dollar?
Yeah. An editor turnover in publishing, especially because it's such kind of an apprenticeship based model, right? There's no real school you can go to learn how to be senior editor that comes from experience. So when those people are leaving and you're going to people that have been there for a minute, you know, it's just so much experience and knowledge lost when they don't have a chance to learn from those senior editors. So yeah, that's sad. And Jenna, I'm glad you read that instead of me because I did not know that the K in Knopf was not silent. So
I did. The things I've randomly learned over the years of publishing.
Yeah. I still can't say gallants. How do you say that one? Gallants.
Well, this to me feels like a very temporary fix. It's going to, you know, it's almost like, you know, having a boat that's sinking and bailing the water out, but not plugging the hole, you know, and primarily for what Christine just mentioned, I you know, it's, they've got younger people who would learn from those older people that are there, that experience trickles down and that keeps the, you know, if you've got a nice rounded, you know, diverse group, then, you know, that experience is there across the board. But when you start chipping away at, you know, that experience, now you've got nobody that really, you know, has a handle on what's happening. And you know, it's just, it's going to progressively become worse. Like this is the wrong way to right the ship. I keep pointing my finger back at Simon and Schuster. I love everything that they're doing and the fact that they are making some drastic changes. But it makes it, if to me, it feels like they are moving in the right direction where I see some of these other publishers moving in the wrong direction.
Yeah. And I think like just, you know, last thing is also like the experience, but you know, if you're an author and you've been working with these editors and it's like, you have a certain amount of trust, you know, I mean, it's author loyalty often isn't necessarily with the publishing house. It's with the editor you've been working with. So, short-sighted and strange decisions, but, what are you going to do?
Yeah. And this is purely anecdotal, but I've been hearing more rumblings among author friends about editor turnover, that they get new editors in the middle of their books. And I don't think that's good for anyone because that editor wasn't passionate about that project. Right. And now they have to pick up something that they know nothing about. But yeah.
Yeah, we've talked about that too. I mean, if you're listening to the show right now and you're, you know, about to sign with any publisher, make sure you've got some way to get your rights back if your editor goes or some type of transition happens there, because I've seen many books die at the publishing company just because the editor is gone and there's nobody left to champion it. And if you don't have some kind of out in your contract, that book can sit there in limbo forever. So in my contracts, I gave them a certain amount of time. They have to publish, you know, within 13 months or whatever of its signing. Or something to make sure that you can get those rights back if, you know, something goes sideways.
Good to know. All right. Scarlett Johansson says she is shocked and angered over new ChatGPT voice. Scarlett Johansson's lawyers are demanding that OpenAI disclose how it developed an AI personal assistant voice named Sky, which Johansson claims sounds uncannily similar to her own voice. OpenAI demonstrated the Sky voice, which many compared to Johansson's in the 2013 film Her. OpenAI CEO Sam Altman, a fan of the film, invited comparisons by referencing it on social media. Johansson was approached multiple times by Altman to license her voice for the AI, which she declined. Johansson then expressed shock and anger over the voice similarity and emphasized the need for legal safeguards around the use of creative work to train AI. OpenAI has since paused the use of the Sky voice, claiming it was based on another actress's voice and not Johansson's. More nefarious goings on. OpenAI.
I was following this on X, which it was interesting to see what people were posting about it. But Sam Altman, when this came out, just posted her. That was his tweet. Just one word. And then, you know, just to be clear, this wasn't a cease and desist from Johansson's lawyers. They just wanted more info about, hey guys, how did you do that? And then they're like, oh no, we're not doing that anymore.
Right. Which just seems to be their go-to move. Like, yeah. Oh, books? What books? We deleted that and we fired everyone. Yeah. And no, you can't have any information about anything that we've ever done ever. Goodbye. Stop calling us.
Yeah. Oh no, we just won't use that voice, but no, you can't have the information. So
I mean, the only reason I kind of sort of believe them on this when they say that there was another actress that, you know, that sounds like her that was used is because of the training process. From what I've heard, they've got like a huge amount of stuff that they have to read in order to capture all the data they need in order to duplicate, you know, 100% of a voice to use it in a conversational mm-hmm. state. So for them to do that with Johansson, they would have to basically take her entire film catalog, you know, any audio that she may have done. A lot of actors and actresses, they do audiobooks, so that may be out there. So it is possible to do it, but it would be a lot more difficult to do it with Johansson's voice versus actually hiring an actor to you know, created from scratch. So I think what really happened here is Altman said, I want somebody who sounds mm-hmm. like Scarlett Johansson. And that's probably what they
did. Yeah, I think that's true. I believe you, it was a different actor, but I think the intention was very much for it to sound like Johansson.
Yeah.
Well, so, especially with that tweet.
Her. Yeah. You're definitely priming people to believe that that was Scarlett Johansson, which again, just feels a little, you know, a little don't look behind the man in the curtain.
I want my AI to sound like Morgan Freeman. I trust Morgan Freeman, you know, so if my AI sounds like him, I think I'll feel a little bit more comfortable.
I don't know who I would want my AI to sound like. I'm going to think on that.
I don't know either.
Well, that's probably coming too, right? A lot of, you know, famous voice actors or, you know, people that just have that type of voice, you know, like they're going to license their data to these things. It would be a very easy model to create. You know, we're going to pay you X dollars for your voice. Like they know exactly how much of it's being used. And they're all looking at this. I saw another article. We don't have it here, but you know, they're about to roll out some changes to Alexa to basically mimic, you know, what's been going on. You know, because right now it's very behind. You know, when you compare it to this, like you can sit there and you can literally talk to your phone and it will answer you. It seems to have emotions. Like it's, you know, huge leaps and bounds ahead of what's in our house right now. The biggest problem that I've heard from them is the processing power that's involved. It's expensive to do that. So to make that shift for somebody like Amazon on every device that's out there, they can't just flip that without somebody paying for it. And it sounds like they're going to go to a subscription model, which is a whole other ordeal. Well,
okay. I know you talked about your CarPlay freaking you out. My CarPlay freaked me out this week. So for my job, I go to a different location every weekday, and it has started coming up on the maps with my location by day of the week where I'm driving. With like, and I have never put that in there because I know how to get there. So it's like, oh, is this the location you want to drive to on Thursday? And I'm like, You're scaring me, CarPlay. That's all. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah.
Start chewing wires under the dash.
Okay. Next.
Yeah. All right. Well, on that alarming note, A24 strikes landmark deal with publishing house Mac to distribute books in stores worldwide. A24 has struck a significant deal with independent publisher Mac to distribute its books in physical stores worldwide. This marks the first partnership of its kind between a film studio and a publishing house. Starting in September, A24's books will be available in bookstores across the US, Europe, and Asia. Previously, these books were only available through A24's online shop. A24 launched its publishing division in 2019, focusing on screenplays and original concept books. Notable releases include hardback screenplays of films like Moonlight, The Witch, and Ex Machina. That's cool.
Yeah.
You know, so when I read this, my first thought was why aren't I doing that yet? Because I've got my own imprint. You know, I've got the ability to put these out. The only thing I'm curious about is there actually an audience for this? Like, how many people are actually buying these? Because, you know, if it's not worth printing like 5,000 copies of the screenplay for The Witch, like, to me, it's not worth pursuing that particular business model.
Yeah, that is interesting. I don't know. I know that you know, novel tie-ins tend to be pretty, you know, I mean, Star Wars has them, Star Trek has them.
Well, these aren't tie-ins though, right? They're publishing the screenplays.
Both.
And original concept books, they also said. So I'm assuming that those are tie-ins to the movies they're doing. Or maybe they're just, you know, doing their own horror, which is kind of interesting. Because that, I do think, a genre that, while publishing is getting slightly better at having more horror books, it's still very underrated, I think.
Yeah. I just thought this was so neat. I didn't even know this existed. So when I read this week, I'm like, that's cool. And I think, hopefully I'm not misremembering that, because sometimes my brain fails me. I think there's original like art with it, maybe, with some of the screenplays, which, you know, I am a total, I don't know what the word is, but I am a sucker for that. I get all kinds of special editions of authors I like that have pair-ups with cool artists. So if that's something they're doing, I need to check into that and see what's going on.
Yeah, that is pretty cool.
There's a market for it. I just feel that it could be niche. Like, I've got a bunch of journals from Seven, which, you know, it's copies of the stuff that the writer from Seven actually wrote in notebooks, you know, which they, that's, you know, like, so the cool ones in the films. Yeah, I mean, it's a cool collector's thing, but like, I don't know how many people actually have that or would want that or would pay what I paid for it, because it's not something that's, you know, out there. But
I do.
I love screenplays. Like, to me, it's fun to read. Like, I love reading screenplays just because they're so fine tuned. You know, like when you, she's holding up iRobot.
I'm such a loser. This one has such cool art in it. I paid too much for it probably, but it was awesome.
Yeah, there's definitely a market for some of this stuff. It's a cool angle that I haven't thought of, and it bugs me that somebody else got to it first.
Well, there's, you know.
Yeah.
And that's all we've got in the news.
Cool.
When you're writing a book, the first draft is the easy part. It's what comes after that hurts. The confusion, the self-doubt, questioning this, questioning that, trying to get feedback so you can feel confident making changes. It's a lot to handle. And that's why I'm delighted to say that this episode of the Writers Inc. podcast is sponsored by AutoCrit. One of the most value-packed memberships for any author, AutoCrit brings you an amazing suite of tools that can make it a breeze to plan, write, and edit your books all in one place. From start to finish, everything you need to produce a strong, confident story is at your fingertips. Get instant developmental feedback on plot, conflict, characters, themes, and more through the Story Analyzer. And edit each sentence to perfection with a complete interactive editing suite packed with reports and insights. And that's not to mention additional benefits like private community forums and live members-only support, and writing sessions every single week. It's an incredible place to be for any writer. And listeners of the Writers Inc. podcast can take advantage of lifetime AutoCrit Pro membership for one single payment. That's right, no renewal fees. Head to autocrit.com/JD to get yourself a lifetime membership now. Big thanks to AutoCrit for sponsoring the show.
JD, who is up this week?
This week, we've got Michael Jammin coming on. Michael's a professional TV writer and showrunner. He's been doing it for over 27 years. He's got credits including King of the Hill, Beavis and Butthead, Just Shoot Me, many others. He's here to talk about his new book. It's called A Paper Orchestra, and it's a collection of essays detailing his time in Hollywood. Here he is, Michael Jammin.
Well, thanks for joining us, Michael, man. I'm really looking forward to this chat. You're responsible. You've written words that I have laughed at on purpose. You wrote them on purpose for me to laugh at for a lot of great shows out there. Some of the best. King of the Hill in particular is always a big favorite of mine, but you know, you've been on Just Shoot Me, or you've written for Just Shoot Me, you've written for Rules of Engagement. These are shows that I steal from liberally when I'm making right. jokes out in the world. So thank you for that. Yeah, but now... Oh, yeah. Glad to have you here. And now you're transitioning into, you've written a book of essays. Another big favorite of mine, by the way, is I read a lot of essays. I don't know why. Just fascinating to me. So I do want to talk about the new book. But we're going to dip a little bit into like that transition, because that's a weird transition. Most people go the other way, you know, or most people dream of going the other way. What was that like?
Well, I think, you know, I've spoken about this in the past, but I'm a TV writer for 28 years, and I think people are surprised to learn that as a TV writer, I don't write what I want to write. I write what people pay me to write,
right.
or I write what I think I can sell. And so I can't afford to spend 6 months on developing a show if I have a good feeling that there's no market for it.
Yeah.
And so, because this is how I keep the lights on. I don't have another income source. So, after a while, this began to weigh on me. And one day I was walking with my wife and I said, I have a really bad idea. I've been thinking of writing a collection of personal essays like David Sedaris. I love his writing. And I just kind of wanted to try something like that. And she goes, well, why is that a bad idea? I said, because if I do it, it's going to take, you know, years to write. And if I sell it, I'll barely make any money. And she was like, oh my God, you have to do it. And I was like, are you not even listening? I just said it was a bad idea. And she said, no, if you do it, you'll find yourself. And so that was the intention. I really wanted to know what it would be like, what it would feel like to write something without getting notes from the network, without compromising any vision, without just doing it, writing what I wanted to write.
Yeah. Yeah. And this book, by the way, A Paper Orchestra is the title. It's available now, right? So it's
yes,
already,
it is.
Look
it is.
At that. So, and great cover, by the way. I was looking at it. And for those listening, because this isn't a video podcast, but for those listening, you need to go check it out. Blue cover. That's how you'll know you're on the right track. It's a series of essays. Were these, did you just sit down and say, I'm going to write a whole book of essays, or did you start writing and publishing this somewhere else?
The beginning started. It was a weird start. I went to my daughter's high school graduation, and she went to a school for the performing arts, like a public high school for the arts. And for the graduation, all the kids, they were singers, dancers, actors. They rented a big theater, the Nokia Theater in Hollywood, and they put on a show. And the show was amazing. Like, these kids were so talented. And then my daughter takes the stage to get her diploma. And then I, like all the other parents, I applaud wildly because I'm proud. And then the show ended, and the MC comes down, you know, it gives his final monologue. It was hilarious. It was a wonderful show. And then the show is over, and everyone starts filing out of the audience. And I just felt like I wanted the show to last just a few more years, and that's it. And so I just started crying in my wife's arms. We started crying together. And then when we were done crying, the theater was pretty much empty. And then we returned to the lobby to find, you know, find the young woman who used to be my baby.
Yeah.
And so I wrote something small, like a few paragraphs, because I really was in mourning for a few days about this. And then I wrote something. I was like, maybe I'll share it on Facebook. Why should I share it on Facebook? Like, Facebook is for posting pictures of what you had for lunch and your vacation pictures. Like, why am I? But I decided, all right, maybe I'll share it anyway with my friends. And it was just a few paragraphs. And the response that I got from my friends was just so encouraging. They were like, because we're, you know, the same age. And they're like, because they were posting photos of their kids overjoyed. You know, they were proud. Everyone's happy. And that's not what I was feeling. I was really grieving. And when I shared that little story, it wasn't much. The response that I got was just so, everyone's like, thank you. Like, I was going to quit Facebook. Thank you for putting into words how I felt, which I don't have the words because I'm not a writer. And so that really kind of gave me the courage to think, well, maybe there's more I could do here. Maybe I can write about stuff that people are afraid to put into words.
Isn't that interesting? Because it's authentic, which, you know, everyone tells you need to go for. Mm-hmm. And if you're not authentic to begin with, I don't know how you aim to be authentic. You know, that I haven't learned that skill yet, I guess. But you just expressed it. I like how you expressed it. It's like grief, which is very uncommon.
Yeah, there's a lot. And that's each in the book, each story kind of tackles, is written not tackles, but each story is kind of about a little emotion. This story is about grief. This one's about rejection. This one is about identity. This one is about shame. And so each story has that little note. And then together, the notes really are what I like to think of as like an orchestra on paper. And so that's why it's paper.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, okay. Coming out of screenwriting, I mean, had you done any sort of prose writing before at any point?
When I was in college.
Yeah.
I took creative writing classes. This is what I wanted to do in college. I wanted to write.
Yeah.
And I tried to get into the creative writing program and I was rejected twice. Like that's like, it's your major. And they rejected me twice. The problem was my writing just was not very good. But I wanted to learn. I wanted to learn how to express myself with words and how to move people with words. And then I moved to LA and I studied screenwriting. And then eventually, you know, I landed a job on Just Shoot Me as a, you know, TV writer. And my career, that's been my career since. But when I finished this book and I, you know, gave it to my literary agent and he's like, I love it. Let's take it out. I love it. And in that moment, it really occurred to me that, you know, even though I was a successful TV writer, this is the writer who I wanted to be in college. I just kind of forgot about him, you know?
So
it really was this wonderful validation of, I was very grateful. Like I could feel like my 19-year-old kid me being grateful for having done this.
Yeah. So do you think, I mean, clearly your screenwriting experience had to have helped shape that writer, like in what ways do you think that happened? Like where was the pivot? Because if you, I don't believe you when you say you weren't a good writer in that.
Oh, I was, but I wasn't. I really, that's what I came into the program. I mean, they felt the same way. I didn't know how to take what was inside me and express it. But one thing I've learned over the years from, like, when I write TV shows, I'm imagining the viewer, they got a remote in their hand and they're ready to turn the, you know, channel.
Right.
And so when I was writing the book, I'm imagining the reader thinking, you know what, there's got to be something better that I can do. So I'm constantly writing with the reader in mind. Like, how do I keep them engaged? How do I keep them to get them to turn the page? And so there's a lot that I took from TV writing and screenwriting that I applied towards, you know, writing these kind of stories. But it definitely helped. But it's different writing. It's a little different.
That's something I know our audience is primarily right, is going to be mostly writers. Are there lessons that you can boil down for them to accomplish that to get that reader to turn the page? Anything you can impart?
Well, that's the goal. Like that's the goal of any, people say, how do I know if my story or my script is any good?
Yeah.
And that is, the answer is really, you give it to somebody and anybody, your mother, your father, whoever you trust. And you say, read it. And they're going to say, what do I know? I'm not a literary agent. And you're going to say, yeah, but you're my reader. And the answer is, give it to them to read. Give them a week. And they come back. What do you think? And they're going to say, well, I like this part or I like that part. Like, that's not good enough. They have to be really, they have to love the whole thing. And what you're going to ask them is, when you get to the bottom of the page, did you want to turn the page? Did you want to find out what happens next? Or did it feel like a homework assignment? And if it felt like a homework, did it feel like a homework assignment or a gift?
Yeah.
And if it felt like a gift, you've done your job. And that applies to thriller, romance, comedy. It's all writing. It's the same, you know, mandate.
Yeah. Is that your group? Is that your ideal readers, the ones that you use to weigh everything out? It's like your family and your wife and in that bunch?
Oh, the only people, no, the only one who gave me any notes on this was my wife. And she was an actor. When I met her, she was an actor on Just Shoot Me. So we've been together a long time. And I trust her opinion. And she was always pushing me to just, you know, go a little deeper. And sometimes I'd give her a story. And she's like, this is no good. And when that happened, I didn't fight with her. I didn't say, but you're wrong. You don't understand me. That's like, all right, I better do it again, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Man, taking criticism like that from strangers is hard, but taking it from your spouse has to be kind of a gut punch, right?
Well, you know, she was very encouraging because some of these stories are very, very intimate. And some of them, some stories are about like ex-girlfriends and stuff. And she just wanted to hear it.
Yeah.
You know? And part of the reason I wanted to finish this, you know, was, you know, my parents are getting up there and I wanted my parents to know who their son was. There's stuff in here that I just have never been. My best friend read it. He called me over the weekend and he's like, my best friend, since I've known him since fourth grade, went to high school, went to college, we were roommates in college. He goes, I didn't know this about you. And it's because why would I have said any of it?
Right.
You know?
Do you find though that, you know, in your screenwriting and in other writing, I mean, doesn't some of that sort of leak out? Like, isn't it, do you use any of that as like source material for everything else you write?
Yeah, for sure. When you always steal from yourself. That when we're in the writer's room, the first thing we talk about is what'd you do this weekend? And then you try to, you know, you share. And often you'll take lines from that happened to you in real life, or characters that you've met, people you've met, and you turn them into characters.
Yeah,
for sure. But this is a little different. This is really, these are personal essays, and they're stories, but they're fictionalized. So they're written like I'm a character in my own story. And so it's much more intimate than just, you know, creating a character.
What did that bring to you? Like, what did you learn about yourself that maybe you didn't know before?
There was so much, because I would start with a memory. I had a list of memories, and I don't have a good memory. So the things that I remembered from my childhood, there must be an emotion attached, or else I wouldn't have remembered it.
Yeah.
And so I'd write these stories, and then I'd get halfway through the story and I'd say, wonder why this little boy did this. Like, why would he do that? And then sometimes I'd start typing the answer, right? And I felt like, no, that's what that little boy would have done on a TV show. That doesn't feel right to me. It doesn't feel like something I did. And so that I wouldn't know, like, why would I do that? And then I would think of another memory from that period. And then I'd say, well, okay, why did I do that memory? And then patterns would emerge. Oh, that kid was anxious. Yeah. Like, and then, you know, and then I would be able to tie it together. And then I just painted a whole portrait of myself that felt very accurate, but I really had not allowed myself to give much consideration to.
Yeah. So did you write things that didn't go in, like ended up on the floor, or?
Oh yeah, for sure. There are 17 stories and there are many that didn't make the cut. Some of them I liked. I just felt like I touched on some of that area in other stories, or some of the stories felt like tonally they didn't fit the other pieces. They didn't feel like it was part of the collection. And some of the stories, particularly some of the early ones, I just felt like I was still finding my footing, my voice, and you know, they're just not good enough. If, you know, I didn't want to put something out there that I didn't feel was 100% I loved.
Yeah. Yeah. So are you saving all that as Paper Orchestra Second Movement?
Yeah. I have another book that I'm starting to work on, and I'm not sure if we'll make it into that book or not. I don't know. It's not like, not everything that comes out of my head is worthy of sharing and being entertaining. Like it's gotta be. I think that's also part of the problems. People, it's very tempting to write about yourself. It's not a diary. This is not a diary. I have to entertain you. I have to keep you invested. It's not for me. It's really for you.
Yeah. Yeah. But so they are all fictionalized, you said. Everything.
Yeah. They're true, but they're fictionalized. So true.
True fiction. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what was that like then, you know, drawing on these real world experiences and these real things that you felt? Like, what was it like to have to kind of mask that, like, you know, are there things that you tried to prevent from leaking through? Is there stuff that you felt, oh, this is too intimate, or this goes too deep?
You know, that's the thing. Because I also perform these pieces like as part of a one-man show. And my biggest concern, because, you know, I'm a TV writer and I'm on social media. Hey, I'm a TV writer. my biggest concern was writing a book that would be read by people, and then people would say, this guy thinks he can write. Like, yeah. That's right. That, ooh, like that would have hurt. And so to me, that's much more, like, in order to convince you that I know how to write, I really have to expose myself. I have to share. I have to be willing to be judged. I have to share parts of myself that are not comfortable. That's the job of the writer. And to me, I'm much more concerned about you judging me as a writer than you judging me as a person.
Yeah. Yeah. Where is that line though? Like, you know, cause I'll share things. There's a worry that I'm sharing too much, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cause I thought about that as well. I thought because there's sharing, then there's oversharing.
Yeah.
And oversharing is when you make your audience or your reader uncomfortable, and sharing is when you make yourself uncomfortable.
Oh, okay. I like that as a distinction.
That's the line I had. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's the bumper sticker right there. Yeah. So that's the, okay. So you've got all these things put together. Let's talk a little bit about the mechanics of this, because a lot of the writers who tune into this, maybe they're looking for that traditional deal, you know. So where did you start? You like, did you already have a literary? It sounded like you already had a literary agent.
Well, I got more agents than you know. So I got I got a TV agent, I got a film agent, I have a manager. But for this, I needed to have a book agent. And then I reached out to my TV agent. I was like, hey, do we have a lit guy? And he's like, yeah, he's in New York. You want a meeting? And I'm like, yeah, I want to talk to him. And so we arranged a phone call. The guy's got to take my phone call because I'm a client at a big agency. So he's got to take the call. And then, what's that?
That's handy.
Yeah, well, but they don't have to represent you, but they have to take
the call. No, but yeah, getting the call, though. Yeah. I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's okay. So then I reached out to him. I told him what I was up to. And he said, okay, well, send me a few stories. So great. I had probably six written. I probably sent him three.
Yeah.
And I emailed them off to him. Did not hear a peep out of him for 6 months. Mm. This is how long it takes. I mean, because they're reading other people. They got things to do.
Exactly.
And but all this time, I'm like, I don't care. I'm writing the book for myself. I'm going to finish the book. I'm going to continue writing the book. And then about 6 months later, I hear back from him. He goes, oh my God, I'm sorry it took so long. I love this. Do you have any more? I go, yeah, I'm almost done. Give me a few more weeks. I'll send you the completed manuscript. And so that's how that began.
Yeah.
And then we shopped it. And what I got back, the feedback that I got back, like maybe we sent it to like 20 or so publishers. And then six were seriously interested. And six said, and of those six, I printed it out. I got, you know, when he said the letters that everybody sent, the note I got most often was in the space of personal essays. It's a very, very niche. It's not romance. It's not thriller. It's personal essays. Like not a lot of people, there's like one guy doing it. It's David Sedaris. He's the guy.
Yeah. Right.
And so the note I got back was platform drives acquisition. I said, what does that mean? Means that if you want to sell it, and they had a good point, like why would someone go into a bookstore and pull my book off the shelf when no one's ever heard of me, you know? And that's a good point. And so I was hoping that the book would be judged based on the merit of the writing and not the merit of it being how well it sells. I figured like, don't they market it? Isn't that what you guys do? No, it's not what they do. It's just not. And I was amazed. I wasn't amazed, but it's not the right word, but there's so much overlap between the publishing world and Hollywood. And I was hoping it might be a little different. It was naive of me to assume it would be any different.
Right.
But
it's not.
And so it's a business. And so that's what made me set out on building an audience on social media.
Okay. So was that your primary marketing tool, was to build up that audience? Did you already have an audience on social media?
No, I wasn't on social media.
Oh, okay.
The way you build a community really is to give, not like, hey, buy my book. It's give. What can I teach you about writing? What can I share with you about my experience as a TV writer?
Exactly.
Here, like, what can I give you? Give, give, and give. And then, you know, finally, when the book is ready, you ask.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. That's why I've logged like thousands of hours of podcasting over the years, for that exact reason. So,
Yeah, you're smart. A lot
yeah.
of work.
It is a lot of work for no pay, by the way, which is just like working in Hollywood.
Yeah, right. No pay. But you're paying yourself,
Yes.
you know.
Yeah. So what's okay, what would be some advice then? Essays are hard. That's a hard genre to crack. You built up a presence on social media to help push that. So maybe you have some tips for writers who are looking to do sort of the same thing. What would you recommend?
Well, first, like, I don't even like the word. I don't even like the genre called personal essays because it sounds
Yeah.
like, who wants to read an essay? It sounds like high school.
Yeah.
And so, I
I
even, but
do. I
that's
like to read essays.
but you're the only one. I mean,
I'm
most
that
people,
nerd. Yeah.
I mean, I appreciate that you do. I like it too. I feel like it's very intimate. It's like this, I feel like the stakes are higher because in fiction, if you ever get sucked into the work and you think, oh, what's going to happen to this character? Is she going to fall off a cliff? At some point, you can say in your head, yeah, but it's just made up. It's okay. Everything's going to be
Right.
fine. It's just made up.
Right.
But with the personal essays, I feel the stakes are higher because the person's real and you know the person's real. And so to me, I think I just find it more interesting. And also, people are worried about AI taking writing. Is AI going to do all the writing? AI can't. A this what I'm writing is AI proof because AI
Yeah.
cannot get into my head and recall my memories and write it in
Right.
such a way that it's
Right.
about, you can't do it. You can do other things, but not that.
Right.
And so that's not what you asked though, but
Yeah,
that's
it's
my
close.
answer.
That's good. That's a good answer. I think so. Yeah, the AI has come up a lot. We've got a little drinking game around the whole thing. So most of us are wasted pretty much all the time at this point. But you're right. I think the point you're making there, allow me to clumsily summarize here, but you're saying AI couldn't take the place of you because what we bring as writers is that internal experience, that lens that we use to see the world. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, so the book is A Paper Orchestra. In the tradition of David Sedaris and Neil Simon, dipping back into that well.
Yeah, I know. Long
Yeah.
recall.
So sounds like it's an amazing book. I think everybody will love it. And I'm gonna go follow you on Twitter now that I know you have a growing
I'm not
social.
very active on Twitter. I'm more
Where are
active
you?
on
Where are you
Instagram.
staying? On
I'm
Instagram?
mostly on Instagram and TikTok. I'm very big, but
Yeah.
Instagram and Facebook. Twitter, Twitter's too short.
I can't do TikTok, man. I don't know. I just can't. There's something about it that just sets my teeth on edge. But Instagram, maybe I should get back to Instagram. I don't know. All right. Well, thank you for taking the time to chat with us. I'm glad we had this opportunity. I know our listeners are going to be glad of it. And everybody can find you where? At michaeljammin.com, right? Is that right?
Yeah, my website's michaeljammin.com and all my social media handles are at Michael Jammin Writer.
Excellent. All right. Well, thanks, Michael, for talking to
Yeah,
us.
thank you for having me.
Okay. So Michael said as a screenwriter, he wrote what people paid him to write, not what he wanted to write, and that this is the writer he wanted to be. He just forgot about him. And I thought that was so interesting.
Yeah.
Have you ever forgot about the writer you wanted to be?
Either of you ever had a writing job that was like an actual job? Like I've worked for newspapers and magazines and stuff like
Yeah.
that where you get assignments.
That's what I do now. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah,
Yeah.
that's different. Like that to me that was work,
Yeah.
and then I would go home and I would write fiction because that's what I did for fun. So I get what he's saying. I mean, you go in and you do the day job, because you're capable of forcing those words out of your
Correct.
brain, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's what you want to be
Yeah.
doing.
I do a lot of writing in my job. Yeah.
I do think it helps though. Yeah. I mean, it's all I feel like it exercises a different part of like the writer brain. So it's sort of like, if you think about like fiction is like one muscle group and like doing something else is a different type of muscle group.
Yeah.
And I think it all helps get it going. And sometimes I feel like, you know, when I have to force myself to write something else, it sort of like unlocks everything and it makes it easier to transition into the fiction writing at the end of the day. Because I'm kind of already like in a word flow, if that makes sense. Sometimes it's the opposite, but sometimes it's very helpful.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Like with my nonfiction stuff, well, I mean, I write a lot of reports for my job. And with the brain computer interface stuff, there's a journal coming out that, you know, my colleagues are like, oh, you should write an article and send it to that paper. And I'm like, oh, but I don't want to because that's not fun. It's academia, but I should. But I do find that the kind of writing, like the stuff that I'm doing for work, is different. I can come home and write fiction and I'm not drained. You know, I'm re-energized by writing fiction. So I totally get that. You went from fiction to nonfiction, sort of.
Yeah, well, I'm writing for Rolling Stone right now on the side. Yeah. So I'm kind of getting a taste of what I used to do. And yeah, honestly, it feels almost like I've got homework. You know, like I've got an article and it's due on this particular date. And, you know, it's cool that they're letting me do basically whatever topic I want. But, you know, it's different from the fiction. But I get what Jenna's saying, too. Like, I think it all exercises. It's almost like having a leg day and an arm day, you know, when you're going to the gym. It's different muscle group.
Yeah, a little bit different. And sometimes, I mean, I found because I write all over the spectrum. I write about, you know, brain health and productivity. And then I do like compilation lists and true crime summaries. Like I'm all over the place, but it's surprising sometimes where like ideas will come from, or, you know, I'll be working on, you know, like a productivity thing. And I'm like, oh, that would actually be a really good thing to include in this character. And it's bizarre, but it really makes a lot of sense. And so I don't know. I just lean into it. I also like deadlines. I really like deadlines. I know I'm strange that way, but they really...
You're weird.
I know. I love them. I have a really hard time without them, actually. So, yeah.
I like deadlines.
But do you set deadlines on the fiction?
I do. The problem, though, is because I don't have an agent yet. Working on that diligently. But so I think some of the problem is that like there's a part of my brain that's just like, I mean, you can set this deadline, but like nobody cares if you turn it in. Whereas, you know, I have to send an email to my editors, like, or I have to post, you know, on a website at a certain time, at a certain day. And so there's no getting around it. And I think like, unfortunately, maybe I'm too smart for my own good. And I'm like, well,
you know, if you want to do a contract that you have to pay me money if you don't hit a deadline, I'll sign up for that. So just let me know.
Christine's setting the bar. I might have to do that. I mean, I've gotten a lot better over time. Like I have actually had to have a lot of stern talking to's about myself. Yeah. You know, like, Jenna, this is your goal and you want to do it. And so I've gotten a lot better. But when I first started writing fiction, that was tough for me.
Yeah. I like the deadlines too. I like the pressure, which probably means there's something wrong with me, but I do way better when I'm stressed out.
Kind of like, well, you know, you're forced to focus. Like there's no, you can't be like, well, like, I mean, I could work on this or I could do this other thing. And, you know, you have no leeway. It's like, no, I have to do this. And you're like, oh, I have to do this. And you sit down and you do it and you're like, oh, I did it. And then you feel really good about yourself. So that's what I've been trying to focus on with my personal deadline. Like, imagine how good you're going to feel. You're going to be so proud of yourself. Come on.
Yeah. You know, I think JD, you were saying it feels like homework writing. And I thought it was really interesting when he was talking about beta readers. Does it feel like homework reading? Because he's like, if this feels like homework versus I think he said a gift, you know that your book is not good. When they're telling you that they're not turning the pages and then not to fight with them and just do it again. So I thought that was a good reminder.
He brought up a good point too on a screenplay, you know, like if somebody's saying, I like this part, but you know, like they're picking it apart basically, like there's still something wrong then because the parts that they're not picking need to be tightened up. And, you know, if you read a screenplay, like we were just talking about, like they are tight, you know, especially for a finished movie. If you take a big blockbuster movie that did really well, read that screenplay. And even if you find like the first draft of it, it's still going to be phenomenally tight. you know, compared to, you know, like the structure of a novel.
Yeah.
So I think that's a good takeaway from that.
Yeah. And they have some real constraints on that. Screenplays are 120 pages, right? You get it in, you can't meander. That's the cutoff. Yeah.
Which is a good challenge. But yeah, I think the feedback thing is I like feedback too. I know I apparently just like pain is what I'm getting from this conversation, but you know, I love it because it's sort of like, even if I don't agree with it, there is something that like pings where it's like, all right, well, but is that valid or is there a different way that I could solve this problem? Like, so it starts feeling like a puzzle to me, not homework. Like, how do I fix it?
Yeah.
Which kind of gets fun because a lot of times the answer isn't exactly what you think it's going to be.
That is exactly. I feel the same way about alpha, beta feedback because you get 2-3 people saying the same thing. They're almost never right about how to fix it, but the what needs fixing is always right. So yeah, you got to push yourself and come up with some cool stuff.
Yeah, because they made a comment. So like something was happening there. And so then it kind of becomes a thing where it's like, all right, well, like, maybe they have an idea of what they think it is, but if you filter that out and you just look at like, all right, this comment happened here, why would it happen there? And you kind of start really thinking about it and teasing it apart, you know, and sometimes the problem isn't like that section. It's something that happened beforehand. You're like, oh, well, if I just put something here, then that goes away. So that's really, I don't know. I like it. I like puzzles. Puzzles and deadlines.
The other thing, I know Kevin is not here, but Kevin talks about not writing things down because he'll remember them. And Michael talked about that too. I'll remember it if there's an emotion attached. And I know he was kind of talking about memories and nonfiction, but I think it's the same thing in fiction. If I have an idea that doesn't give me an emotional response, I'm going to forget about it. And the ones that I do feel something about, I remember. And then they'll turn into something else.
I read something years ago about Albert Einstein, where he wore the same clothes every day, the same outfit, because he didn't want to put any conscious thought into what he was going to wear that particular day. Like, he felt there was a limited amount of brain power and he wanted to really focus that brain power. And he wrote everything down. Yeah. Like, if it was something he could get out of his head by writing it down and revisiting it later so he could forget about it for a little bit, he would do it. So I've kind of followed that same model all my life. Cause the guy's, you know, obviously fairly smart. He was onto something.
So you write everything down?
But I've known a lot of people along the same lines as Kevin, you know, that feel that, it, you know, if they're not going to remember that idea 12 hours later, then it probably wasn't worth, you know, remembering to begin with and just move on. I mean, for me personally, I'm juggling so many different projects. If I don't write stuff down, it would come apart.
I just think like it's easy to lose things. And I think like, and I know I've had things where I'm like, oh, that's so good. And I have that emotional attachment. But if I get swamped all of a sudden, it's gone. And I've been very sad about that because it's like, oh, like what was that? It was so good. And it's sometimes it comes back, but sometimes it doesn't. And I think, I've just gotten into the habit of writing things down, like a quick note in my phone. I've got post-it notes all over the house so that I can just jot a thought down and stick it on a counter and move on. And I find that I actually get more done. And if I write it down, I often don't have to reference the note itself. Sometimes I do, but usually just the act of writing it down is enough for me to, like, I don't know if there's a cork board in my brain, you know, it's like it pins it to it somehow. I have no idea if this is true, but I did read somewhere that when you write something down, you repeat it 5 times in your brain when you're handwriting. And so I don't know if maybe that has something to do with it.
It lights up a different part of your brain. I don't know about the 5 times thing, but it definitely activates a different part of your brain when you're handwriting.
So, that usually I've tried to get in the habit of doing that. And I've got like, you know, little notebooks and things everywhere just to kind of, you know, if I'm thinking it and I want to keep it, I just make a note and.
Yeah. And I will not go on to my diatribe about why we should still use cursive writing because it accesses a different part of our brain. But anyway, moving on.
I can't not write. Well, my handwriting is atrocious, but it's like half cursive anyway. It's just so much easier. Like who has time to print?
They don't teach it now. My son can't read my cursive because he was never taught it. So if I want to like you know, write something down that's a secret from him. I write it in cursive, give it to
my son. Got in trouble for teaching himself cursive, and I had to go to a parent-teacher conference for it, and was like, are you kidding me right now? This is a productive use of your time.
Your child is using the forbidden text. Yes.
I know, basically.
Must be punished.
Oh, I love those. And my son got written up in kindergarten for saying, I like to eat stinky worms. And I was like, for real? We're going to die on this hill? Okay.
Right, yeah. Of all the problems in your day, this is one you had to hone in on? All right. Okay. All right. I see where you are in your life.
Oh, my gosh. The other thing I just wanted to touch on, and I know this is more important in nonfiction, is the feedback he got from the agents that didn't want the book, that platform drives acquisition. So then he got on social media, built it up, is talking about building a community to give. Nonfiction, I think that's important. I'm not so sure that's as important in fiction.
I don't think so. I mean, I think it doesn't hurt, obviously. I mean, there are countless examples of, you know, popular booktubers and bookstagrammers over the years who have gotten agents and gotten published, which can certainly like get you your foot in the door, but you still have to write a decent product. And I think like with fiction, that's the more important thing at the end of the day is the story you're telling. And so you don't need a platform to do that.
I can tell you from they've been having this argument for forever and ever. So like back in the 90s, I ghost wrote a memoir for a very famous actor who was an A-list actor. And I'm not allowed to say the name because of the NDA, but he received an insane advance for this book. I wrote it. The book came out and it fizzled and died. didn't hit anything. Nobody cared. But like they paid all this money because they felt that he had a platform. And I feel like they've carried that logic through over the years. You know, like that. You know, fame as a platform has kind of evolved into social media as a platform, or you know, this is a platform. But like they don't really know what the correlation between that platform and sales actually is. But they will still ask you. You know, if you walk through the door and you're looking for an agent right now, your agent's going to ask you what type of social media presence you have. I can tell you, every agent, if they read a manuscript or a query letter that they like, the first thing they do is they jump on Google and they see what comes up.
Yeah.
You know, and if nothing comes up, that's a problem. If the wrong thing comes up, that's a problem. So you want to try and control that message. So I think to that extent, it's worth doing. It doesn't necessarily hurt you, like you said, to have any type of presence out there. Mm-hmm. But you know, if you can fine tune it, you know, all the better.
I need a VA.
Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. So JD, who is up next week?
Next week, we've got Ellery Lloyd coming on. Her last novel, The Club, was a New York Times bestseller and a Reese's Book Club pick. She's back with a new mystery called The Final Act of Juliet Willoughby. So Ellery is actually a pseudonym for a husband and wife writing team. They're going to basically explain their process and how they managed to crank out novel after novel working together. I find this fascinating when a husband and wife can do this, which is one of the reasons why we booked them. But Ellery Lloyd, really two people. This is going to be good.
It's a really interesting interview. So we'll have that next week.
Ooh, I'm excited.
If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers, Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.